Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. Joining us today is Arno Michaelis. Arno is now a peace activist, but spent the late 1980s and early 1990s deeply involved with racist skinhead organisations and was lead singer of the hate metal band Centurion, which sold 20,000 CDs by the mid-90s and is still popular with racists today. Single parenthood, love for his daughter and the forgiveness shown by people he once hated all helped to turn his life around, bringing him to embrace diversity and practice gratitude for all life. Today he's a speaker, author of the book My Life After Hate, and very fortunate to be able to share an ongoing process of character development working with Serve to Unite, Leveraging, an online magazine. STU engages students creatively with a global network of peacemakers and mentors in partnership with Against Violent Extremism, The Forgiveness Project and Over My Shoulder Foundation. He's here to talk to us today about his life, overcoming hatred, his peace work and how all this might relate to the Middle Way. Hello Arno, welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi Barry, thanks so much for having me on, I really appreciate it.
Okay, well, tell us your story, Arno.
Well, I was born and raised in a northern suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, pretty well-to-do neighborhood. I grew up in a nice house in a nice neighborhood, never went hungry, never took a beating. I actually had a fairly idyllic childhood compared to most kids on the face of the earth, unfortunately. And though I had a lot of positive affirmation in my life early on, and my parents were together and they did both love me very much. I grew up in an alcoholic household, and alcoholism was really a problem in both sides of my family, and it created a lot of emotional violence in our house, and I responded to that by starting to lash out at other kids.
Yeah.
So I was a bully on the school bus as early as kindergarten. In elementary school, I started getting in fights in the schoolyard, and as I acted out and I got kind of a rise out of teachers and principals, I started to get a thrill from it. I got stimulation from causing the trouble. And like any other kind of addiction, what gets you off the first time is kind of old hat after you do it 10 times. So I kept escalating my antisocial behavior as I grew older. And so in middle school, I started breaking and entering. I started doing vandalism. In high school, I started drinking myself. I got into punk music, which I still love very much. I never want to make it sound like punk is a gateway drug to being a white power skinhead. But as it was, to me, an angry, bored, unchallenged kid, punk was really about smashing things and rebellion and aggression. And that's the kind of frame of mind I was in when I first heard racist skinhead music. So it was really kind of a natural progression for me. By the time I was 16 years old, I was already very familiar with violence. I was familiar with hatred. I felt like I hated my family. I hated the place I lived. I hated my school. I hated the kids there. I hated the teachers, the principals. I hated the police. I hated society.
What about yourself?
Yeah, well, and that's something that you never think of, but I now understand that really all this outward direction of hate was a reflection of my poor self-image. So I would agree with that entirely, that it was self-hatred that motivated all the external hatred. So the narrative of white supremacy really kind of gave me a context and a purpose, like kind of a justification for all the hate I felt. and a direction for the violence. And best of all, at that point in my life, it really pissed people off. So that was really the biggest attraction for me, is that the swastika was so repulsive to civil society. And I felt like civil society was my enemy, and I wanted to oppose it at every turn. So the appeal of white supremacist hate groups really had a lot to do with it seemingly being against the status quo.
But you weren't just against people from different ethnic origins. Were you also homophobic as well? And were you misogynistic too?
Well, I think in I was certainly homophobic. I have some history of that in my family that helped shape that view. My uncle came out when he was 17 in the kind of mid-60s, and my grandma had him committed because of it, and which was not uncommon back then. And in fact, that's what any loving parent would be expected to do if their child came out as a homosexual. So the place where my uncle was committed was a nightmare, and he was drugged and raped by priests, and it really kind of destroyed what was left of his psyche at that time and created a huge rift between him and the rest of my family. And I didn't really find any of this out until 2010, after he had died and my aunt had killed herself shortly after.
Okay.
So homophobia literally devastated my family over the years. But all I knew as a kid growing up was that my uncle was gay, and he was really messed up, and it was a horrible thing. And it really, like, a lot of the response to that in my family was to blame him for what had happened to him. And I kind of fell in with that. So, it was easy for me as a teenager to be violently homophobic. So there was certainly that element in, the targets of my hatred. Certainly white supremacy is a misogynistic practice as well. Typically women are looked upon as really just breeders and trophies and kind of conquests. I don't know that misogyny would have been a real good way to describe the way that I kind of felt it. I've never, never forced myself upon a woman. There was one incident where I slapped a girlfriend of mine after she had hit me. It really wasn't in self-defense, but it was kind of provoked by her attacking me first. And I felt horrible about that. It's interestingly, I that weighed upon me, much greater than a lot of the wanton violence I had engaged in against other males. I think a lot of that had to do with seeing my mom struggle so much as I grew up, and also seeing my grandmother struggle. It was always, and my grandmothers. So it was in my family, it was always the women who had to pick up the pieces and keep some kind of semblance of normalcy. As the men were all out drinking and partying. So I think I've always kind of had a sympathy for women, and now being a father to a daughter, that's an even stronger feeling, I think.
And that, you say in the book, that was a turning point for you, because you were involved in these movements for quite a period of time, for about 6 or 7 years, weren't you?
Correct.
But it was. Did you say that having your daughter was a turning point in your life?
Yeah, I definitely, fatherhood was a deciding factor in my decision to leave the movement, as we called it. But I really think, especially after working with young people today and telling my story over and over again, I can really look back and I feel like by 7 years, I was kind of looking for an excuse to leave.
Right. Okay.
I felt this growing sense of exhaustion that really had begun the second I got involved. And the exhaustion brought me to the point where by 1994, after I had become a single parent and a second friend of mine had been murdered in a street fight, I saw that those two kind of converging events as the excuse I was looking for. And that was really when I made the decision to leave hate groups and to begin a new phase of my life.
Yeah. And then it was interesting you use the term exhaustion there. Does, in a sense, hatred require enormous amounts of energy?
It absolutely does. And it does in all sorts of ways. One of the sources of exhaustion that I felt early on was that as an adherent to a fundamentalist ideology, which the white supremacist narrative definitely is, you essentially have to block out all of the information that comes to you on a daily basis that contradicts your ideology. And that's the vast bulk of it. And the mental energy required to do that is immense.
Yeah.
Anything that didn't support the stance that white people were different than everyone else and superior to everyone else and incapable of living in peace with everyone else had to be either outright denied or it had to be spun in a way so that it became palatable to the ideology. So that process, it takes a lot of mental and spiritual energy, and it's a draining process. It's not one that rekindles the energy.
And presumably, it requires constant reinforcement as well. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime I would be in a situation or have an experience that contradicted the narrative I was trying to establish an identity along, I would need to create distance between myself and that experience. And so I did that with a lot of alcohol. I did it with white power music. I did it by surrounding myself with other pissed off white kids. And I kind of created a like a fortress that my hate could live in, and I would retreat there at every every time it was challenged. That's kind of where I went back to. And for someone who's fairly intelligent and curious about the world, as I had been growing up, it makes that process all the more difficult.
I can imagine,
because you can't indulge your curiosity. You can't question the narrative that you're assuming as an identity. And so that inability to question and the inability to think outside of this box I had put myself in was a huge contributing factor to this exhaustion that I felt.
This reminds me of an interesting story that you tell of the woman in McDonald's,
right?
How that affected you. And then you went out afterwards and you had to sort of reinforce again your behavior. Could you just tell us a little bit about that? Because I find it's a very interesting story.
Yeah, absolutely. I the exhaustion came from all sorts of directions. One was the willful narrowing of mind and perspective. Another was when I hurt people, I felt bad about it. I knew I was doing something horrible and I had to suppress that knowledge. Yeah. And as kids went out and committed violence, trying to impress me, trying to outdo me, they committed violence that made my stomach turn. That was even more exhausting, but was perhaps most exhausting during that 7 year period was when people who I was openly hostile to treated me with kindness, when they had the courage to respond to my hostility with forgiveness and with courage and with humanity. And I was very fortunate that happened over and over again in all sorts of instances. But early on in my skinhead days, I had this idea that if I ate nothing but ramen noodles, I would have more drinking money. So I came up with that because I'm a gifted genius. I know this is my mother says I'm a gifted genius. So because I'm so smart, I figured this out. And the one day of a week I would eat something aside from ramen noodles was on payday, at which point I would go to McDonald's and I'd get a Big Mac. And it still kind of cracks me up nowadays as I drive past a McDonald's. And I remember those days when I would sit there all week salivating about getting a Big Mac and looking forward to it. And it never occurred to my gifted genius self that if I didn't drink so much, I could probably afford to eat more Big Macs, yeah. Which would be worse for me. I'm not, you know, it's debatable. But what happened was on this payday where I cashed my check and I went to the McDonald's nearby, the check cashing place, I walked in and was immediately struck by an elderly black woman who worked there behind the counter. And the reason I was struck is she had this absolutely beautiful smile that was incredibly genuine, and it was just kind of shining on everybody who walked through that door. It was very much like sunlight. It was unconditional. It didn't matter who you were, what color your skin was, how much money it made or didn't make, or if you're a gangbanger, a white power skinhead, or whatever. That smile was there for everyone, and the smile made me very uncomfortable. I was here. I am trying to hate black people, and here's this sweet old lady smiling at me, and it's making it very difficult to maintain a hatred for her. And so it was disconcerting. And I, as I went and ordered my food, and she was very pleasant, I really wanted to just get out of there as soon as I could and go eat my sandwich. So a week goes by and I forgot all about her, and I dropped out of high school and I was working in a t-shirt factory. So I would do that when I was 40 hours a week, third shift. And then when I wasn't working, I'd be drinking and picking fights in the street and listening to white power music and eventually making it myself. The next payday comes and I go to get a Big Mac again at the same McDonald's, and there she is again. And this time she recognizes me and she remembers what I ate and she's asking me about my day, and we're having this interaction. And again, this is like really threatening this house of cards ideology I had, and it's defying everything that I'm trying to believe in. So I'm really uncomfortable again, and I get my food and I get out of there. A week goes by again. On the Saturday in between paydays, I got paid on Wednesdays, I got a swastika tattooed on the middle finger of this hand, which I've since had removed. And it was strategically on the middle finger so that when somebody replied to my hostility with some of their own, I could show them that middle finger and ask them what they're going to do about it.
Yeah.
And it was purposefully designed to repulse people and to offend them and to provoke them. And I certainly wasn't thinking of the sweet old black lady who worked at McDonald's when I got the tattoo. But when the next payday came and I went back to the McDonald's to get my Big Mac, as I walked in the door, I saw her behind the counter. And the first thing I thought was, I don't want her to see this tattoo. And I even stood there in the doorway for a minute, like hoping that someone else would come to take my order. Nobody did. I thought about, you know, where the next closest McDonald's was. And it was, you know, I was on foot. I didn't want to take it. I was on the bus and I was hungry. So I steeled myself to go up to the counter, and I figured I'd keep my hand in my pocket and she wouldn't see the tattoo. And but when I tried to pay for it, of course, she saw the back of my hand, and she just said to me, "What is that on your finger?" And I was 6'3 already by that time. I stood a good foot taller than her, but I felt about 6 inches high when she asked me that question. And all I could do was stare down at my boots and say, "It's nothing." I couldn't say this is a swastika because I hate black people. I could say was it's nothing. And she waited until I looked up, and she looked me in the eyes, and she said, "I know that's not who you are. Oh, you're wow. a better person than that."
Yeah.
And I just said, "Can I just have my Big Mac, please?" And I got my food, and I scurried out of there, and I never came back. And I would love to say that I walked out of the McDonald's realizing how stupid racism was and giving it up at that point. But In fact, I went home and I got drunk as fast as I could, and I blasted white power music, and I went out in the streets and I picked a fight with the first person I could find, because I was trying to put as much distance between myself and this moment of humanity that I experienced as I possibly could. It made me that uncomfortable.
Yeah, but you remembered it though, didn't you? And it obviously sowed a seed.
The human mind doesn't really understand the function of subtraction. Once something happens to us, it's with us forever. We can't get rid of it. We can't remove it from our memory. All we can do is add things to our mind. And I tried to add hatred and violence for 7 years to try to suppress that memory and other memories of kindness and other experiences that contradicted the narrative of hate and violence. And I could never successfully do that. The process of doing that was another huge factor in the exhaustion that I felt. And the act of kindness that the woman at McDonald's bestowed upon me and other acts of kindness all planted seeds that stayed with me and ultimately took root and blossomed and grew to leave less and less room for hate in my heart. And I really honestly believe that those experiences were huge factors in my turnaround, even though it took 7 years in some cases for them to come to fruition. And that if any of those experiences had been missing, it's entirely possible that that second murder could have driven me deeper into white supremacy.
Sure, yeah.
So I'm every day I'm very grateful for that woman's kindness and for the example she set for me.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story, Arno. You said in the book, your past is a demonstration of the human ability to frame reality. We seem to be talking about that, but could you just sort of expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. It really occurred to me to think about it in terms of a lens. I see we're both wearing eyeglasses, and we need it to, because it corrects our vision. It helps, it corrects for nearsightedness or farsightedness. And when we stake our identity in an ideology, that ideology becomes a lens also. And everything we see, everything we experience in life happens, is processed through that lens. So as a white power skinhead, my lens indicated that white people were different and better than everyone else and incapable of living in peace with everyone else. And when you go through life with that predisposition, with that sort of prejudice, everything that happens is processed through that lens. So it literally changes the reality that you live in. When you walk around every day and when you see someone who's not white and they're immediately an enemy and they're immediately a threat just because of the color of their skin, that affects your reality. It affects the way that you experience life. And conversely, if we can, first of all, be aware that we have lenses like this and be mindful that our thoughts and our attitude and our beliefs help to shape this lens and control how it processes reality, then we can change it for the better.
Yeah.
So today I really make an effort to make my lens one of gratitude. And one of kindness,
yeah.
And one of forgiveness. Not only for people who may commit transgressions against me, but most importantly, in my case, forgiveness for myself. Because if I'm unable to forgive myself for the mistakes I made and the harm I've done, then I'm not in a position to truly atone for that harm and those mistakes in a position to help other people come to the same realizations.
Sure. And I wouldn't say it's a given, but I think, if you've got the ability to be kind to yourself, I think it makes it a lot easier to be kind to others as well. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, absolutely. I think without self-love and self-kindness, self-forgiveness, it really like retards our ability to demonstrate or to exhibit those qualities in relationships with other people. So I really believe that outer peace and peace in our society is dependent on inner peace, and you can't have inner peace if you're beating yourself up, if you're disgusted with yourself, if you don't have kindness for yourself, if you don't have love for yourself. You're never going to be able to really effectively manifest those things in an outward way.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, just back to the book. I personally found the book very moving, actually. Disturbing at times, but I think above all, inspiring, Arno. And perhaps, you know, what we're talking about now, what stood out for me most was how seriously honest it was. And it challenged me to think, you know, how honest I am about myself too. And I'm just thinking here, related to this, because of all the social conditioning that we're all subject to you know, from wherever we come from, that to a lesser degree, most of us are all prejudiced in some ways. And do you think we could make more progress in the sense if we were a bit more honest about that we could recognize that, you know, you say, well, you know, when I was a child, I had this influence, my parents or my uncle, and that was actually quite uncomfortable. But often we're scared to say these things because we're scared of being labeled.
Right. I think honesty and courage kind of go hand in hand. And it takes a lot of courage to be honest in many instances. But at the same time, the honesty is very liberating.
Yeah.
So when you really open up and you stop trying to hide things, it's a great feeling of freedom.
Sure.
And it's also, going back to exhaustion, it's a huge energy saver, you know, so you're not expending all this energy to hide things and to be something that you aren't, and to try to deny problems you may have, or you try to hide those problems. So when we're not expending that energy trying to put up this facade of how we think the world wants to see us, or who society expects us to be, and we can really just get closer to the genuine human being that we all are. Yeah. Inside, it becomes very therapeutic, and it becomes very transformative, not only personally, but also with other people. A lot of the honesty that I'm graced to be able to exhibit was really modeled for me by other people. The old woman at McDonald's being one of them.
Yeah.
So I'm following examples set by others, and in the course of doing so, I'm setting an example for other people. So it really becomes a powerful way to live your life, and I think it's a key to happiness is the ability to be truthful with yourself about your feelings, about, and probably most importantly, about your vulnerabilities.
So it's like sort of having the strength to be vulnerable in a sense.
Exactly. It's a really imposing thing in our society, especially for men, this kind of Western image that we're all kind of expected to live up to by society. Men aren't, you know, boys don't cry.
Yeah.
Boys are tough. Boys, you know, it's interesting that fearful is really interpreted as fearless.
Yeah.
So it's kind of seen like if a man isn't violent, he's a coward. When in actuality, being violent is simply falling into a cycle of aggression. So it really takes no more willpower to be violent than it does to fall into a raging river and be swept downstream. But to contradict the violence and to not become part of the cycle of violence, that's really going against the stream. That's really what takes courage. But our society is kind of looks at it the other way. We throw parades for wars, and we build statues to commemorate hundreds of thousands of men and women killing each other.
Yeah.
When actually, you know, that doesn't take any bravery to do that. That's it's falling into something that's already happening.
Yeah. Related to this, that the first time you really told your story was actually in a creative writing class to an ethnically mixed audience. What was that like? Was that very powerful?
It was a really moving experience for me, because it had been a long time since I had sat down and listened to someone who had a different skin color than I did. Throughout my time in hate groups, obviously, I had very little contact with anyone who wasn't white, with anyone who wasn't a vehement, violent white racist, actually. So to sit and listen to a black woman talk about her life and write about her struggles and her vulnerabilities, it was transformative in all sorts of ways. But I think first and foremost in that I was kind of awed by her bravery to not only open up and talk about the difficulty of having a child with someone who was addicted to drugs and what she had to deal with and working two jobs to keep the lights on and to keep her kids fed. I could relate to that because I it's what my mother had went through as I was growing up. And it was also really, because she was so courageous and so open, it inspired me to follow suit. Again, it was an example that was set for me as far as honesty and openness goes.
Yeah.
And it really helped set the course of my life from that point forward.
Do you think the fact that that you were loved, though, as a child, played a part in your recovery, perhaps? You know, I mean, to what degree would you say people involved in hate groups haven't experienced much empathy in their early lives?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's I appreciate you bringing that up, because it's something that really needs to be understood, is that without my parents, both of my parents, undying love and devotion to me, for all the mistakes that my father made and all the suffering that was caused by his alcoholism, he also never gave up on me. And I remember even as this skinhead loser who was really just like a detriment to society, he let me know that even though he didn't support what I was doing and he didn't agree with my ideology, he was still proud of me just in the human being that I was.
Yeah. He could see past all that.
Exactly. I remember him telling me that. And at the time, it really was a head scratcher, because I was like, well, wait, you're not racist. You're not violent. Like, why are you proud of what I'm doing? And he said, you know, I'm not proud of what you're doing. I'm ashamed of what you're doing, but I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you, the person that you're capable of being. And it's really tragic that a lot of people don't have that kind of parental support.
Yeah.
And a good example of what can happen when that parental love is lacking is the Sikh temple shooting of August 5th, 2012.
Yeah.
Wade Michael Page, the man who perpetrated that atrocity, had estranged himself from his family. He had estranged himself from his girlfriend. He was 40 years old, working a minimum wage factory job. He had no career. He had everything in his life was going to pieces because of his own practice of hate and violence. And he didn't have a family who would reach out to him and say, hey, you know what? We're still here for you. And I think that was a big factor in him finally reaching a point where nothing seemed to make sense other than homicide followed by suicide. So I would absolutely say that my parents were as a huge factor in my turnaround, and that without their love and support, it would have been all the more doubtful and all the more improbable.
Yeah. Okay. You say you pity racists as much as you pity their victims. To me, this sort of relates to sort of Gandhi's idea that, you know, you have a problem with someone's beliefs without having to hate the person.
Right. And it's I do that in a not only a human sense, but in a tactical sense, because I know that reflecting the hatred that they're putting out is what they're looking for. That serves their purpose. And so to truly defy hatred, you can't reflect it. You can't keep cultivating it. You need to understand that people who are perpetrating hate are miserable. They're suffering. They're living an absolutely atrocious life where every waking moment they spend terrified of the world around them. And they don't experience the most beautiful aspects of being a human being. They don't experience love. They don't experience kindness. They don't experience forgiveness. They don't experience compassion. And all they do experience is fear and ignorance and anger and hatred and all, you know, all these really difficult emotions. So if we can take a couple moments to imagine what it would be like to live like that, we could understand how bad racists have it. Yeah. And I've taken a lot of flack from I have a lot of people who accuse me of being an apologist for racists because I refuse to hate them. And my response, as I said, is that I do this in a tactical sense as well as in a human sense.
Yeah, no, I can certainly agree with that, Arno. We can't go through life, though, without at times people really pissing us off. What strategies do you now have if you see that you might become emotionally hijacked if someone cuts you up in traffic or something like that?
Right.
What coping strategy do you have?
I think probably the most powerful tool that I use in that regard and that anybody can use, it's a very simple, very powerful four-word truth, and it's that hurt people hurt people. When human beings are happy and well-adjusted, there's no reason to go hurting other people. There's no reason to be rude. There's no reason to be inconsiderate of other people's presence. So what that means is that when people are rude and inconsiderate, when people are hurtful, whether it's verbally or physically or whatever, they're doing that because they're suffering. And if we can be mindful of their suffering, we can respond to their transgressions with compassion. And that by no means means that we applaud them or accept them or say it's okay. Yeah. But we understand that that person is acting that way because something is going seriously wrong in their life. And once we can transform the situation into one where we feel compassion for the offender, we now we're not fueling this cycle of violence. And we're removing ourselves, and probably most importantly, we're removing our psyche and our spirituality from the cycle of violence. And instead of adding to it, we're actually soothing it with compassion. And even if it is an incident in traffic, which is a great example, as I do a ton of driving and it happens all the time, I'll see someone who's driving like an idiot or they're being inconsiderate to other people. I remind myself that, they're probably not doing that just for the hell of it, although I seem to be doing things like that for the hell of it way back in the day. That they're ultimately doing that because there's some sort of problem going on. And that way, it's also important to remind yourself that we don't really know what their motivations are. So, our minds are storytellers. Our human mind is really good at making up stories and creating justifications for things and assigning motivation to people when we really don't know what their motivation is. And so if we're going to make up a story, why not make up a good one and say, hey, maybe that person who's driving, who's cutting all these people off and driving like a maniac, maybe there are kids in the hospital. You know, maybe they need to get to work or they're going to get fired. You know, there's all sorts of good reasons they could be doing that. So why assign a negative one to it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just on the subject of story there, Arno, Bjorn Ehler, who I believe is a friend of yours.
No, oh, he's a dear friend of mine. He's my brother. He's a great guy.
Well, he did an interview with me a few weeks ago. Again, I found him a very inspiring guy. And for the listeners out there, Bjorn was a survivor of the massacre on Utøya Island in Norway. And one of the things he says, he feels he continually needs to tell his story. Is it similarly important for you to do that, or can it at times become repetitive? Because I imagine you've told your story hundreds of times now.
I have, and I've been very fortunate to tell it, sharing a stage with Bjorn a number of times, and I look forward to doing that more in the future. And I totally agree. It's very important for me to tell my story, and every time I do it, even though I've done it hundreds of times, it helps my healing process. It helps me become a better person, and it makes me a more effective peacemaker. Every time I examine my mistakes and I share my vulnerabilities with the world, it empowers me as a peacemaker and as a human being. And it's also a very therapeutic thing. I've had people, especially like kids who are, you know, teenagers and going through this awkward hormonal time, and they're afraid of what people think of them. And the idea of being up on stage talking about all the stupid things they did is just terrifying. And they'd say to me, like, how can you do that? I can't imagine getting up on stage and talking about these mistakes you made like that. And for me, it's part of my personality, is that it would be much more difficult for me to not talk about it than it would be to get on stage in front of, I don't care how many people. I mean, I've talked in front of thousands of people. It's not a difficult thing for me to do, just because I've always been kind of a ham. I've always been a storyteller. I don't mind being the center of attention. But again, the process of telling the story is really what's important. Whether it's on stage or whether it's in the written form. And it reminds me of a process I go through. Nowadays, I pretty much do speaking and writing and education full time, but I used to be an information technology consultant. Right. I'd been doing that independently since 2001 and professionally since 1999. And a lot of times, if I'd run into an IT problem that I was stuck on, I'd be like, I'd have to reach out to some Uber geek friends of mine and ask for their help. Now, respectful of their time, I want to compose an email that really like defines the problem and talks about everything I did to try to solve it. And quite often, I'd say 7 times out of 10, while I'm in the process of composing this email, saying, okay, here's the problem, this is what I've tried, all of a sudden it dawns on you, oh, I didn't try this. So just that process of writing and expressing the problem can often reveal solutions. Yeah. And I absolutely believe that applies to our psyche and, yeah, and to our spiritual and mental health, is that if we have a problem, if we're depressed, write about why you're depressed. Right. Just write about what it feels like to be depressed. Don't write looking for a solution. Write just looking to pour those feelings out. And in the process of doing so, quite often the solution will present itself.
Yeah. Okay. Well, could you tell us now a little bit about your work as a peacemaker, as a peace activist?
Yeah. I every day, honestly, I feel grateful to lead the life I do and to know all the amazing people I do. Bjorn being one of them. I met Bjorn in 2014. He came to Milwaukee to interview me for a film he was working on, and we hit it off and we became great friends. And I've been fortunate to spend time with Bjorn in Norway and Denmark and Bosnia, sharing our stories together and kind of empowering those who are working to counter violent extremism. And a lot of the work I actually do is just what I'm doing right now. It's storytelling. It's talking. It's having a conversation. A lot of it is listening to people also.
Right.
As much as I like to tell stories, and I as you're probably gathering, I'm capable of just rambling on incessantly. I'm also trying to be mindful that it's important to listen to other people and give them space and give them a chance to tell their story. And so I do that mainly nowadays in the context of Serve to Unite. Serve to Unite is an organization that was founded by the Sikh community of Oak Creek, Wisconsin, in response to the August 5th, 2012 Sikh temple shooting, where 6 people were murdered And one man is still in a coma from the violence that happened that day. The idea behind Serve to Unite was to transform this atrocity into something inspirational that will bring people together from that day forward. So it was a few months after August 5th that Pardeep Kalika and I met. Pardeep's father, Satwant Singh Kalika, was the last person murdered that day. And he was the last person murdered because he was fighting off the white supremacist gunman with a butter knife.
Wow.
And he was shot 5 times before he fell. And in doing so, he bought enough time for the police to get there. And the police ultimately ended the situation. So we talk about Satwant's bravery and we talk about his commitment to his community and to his people. And but most of all, we talk about Pardeep's healing process to try to cope with his father's murder. And his healing process is essentially rooted in service to other people. Just and service is a pillar of the Sikh faith, as it is in many faith traditions. And rather than kind of just like soak in his own sorrow and his own heartbreak, of which there was plenty, Pardeep immediately like reached out to, first of all, his family and his community and asked, you know, what could he do to help them? Yeah. And then he started reaching out to schools and churches, and specifically in like the inner city of Milwaukee, where there's a lot of people struggling because of very dire socioeconomic circumstances. And Pardeep reached out to them and said, hey, what can I do to help make your community more peaceful? How can we address gun violence? How can we address poverty and drugs? You know, what can we do to see each other as human beings and to live in a more humane society? And when you meet Pardeep, you can really see the effects that that practice has had on him. He's the most like down to earth, genuine, compassionate human being that you'll ever meet. And honestly, someone you'd never imagine whose father was murdered by a white supremacist, because you really won't detect a hint of anger or bitterness. And it's not because he's not angry about it. He's absolutely outraged at the injustices that led to that happening and to the injustices that feed systemic issues in our society that create these problems. But rather than cultivate anger, he truly defies those systems by practicing human qualities, by practicing compassion, practicing kindness. So Pardeep and I kind of started the student chapter portion of Serve to Unite by doing talks at schools. We would go do a talk where each of us would tell our story, and then we'd talk about how we met and the friendship that we have now and the brotherhood that we have. And when we get done with our talk, we end up with a whole auditorium full of kids who are really like fired up about helping other people and about being peacemakers and about identifying themselves as human beings. And so Serve to Unite gives them a framework to do that. When we talk about countering violent extremism, we want to look at the factors that lead people to get involved in violent extremism. And what those factors are very basic human needs. Human beings of all ages, but especially young people, you need a sense of identity. You need a sense of purpose, and you need a sense of belonging. Mm-hmm. And if those needs aren't met in a healthy way, they're going to be met in an unhealthy way, whether that's substance abuse, whether it's actually becoming a white supremacist, whether it's becoming a member of the so-called Islamic State, whether it's becoming a member of a street gang, or whether it's becoming a vicious businessman who doesn't care about who he tramples in the process of amassing wealth. These are all manifestations of those needs not being met in a healthy way. So what Serve to Unite does is it demonstrates that we can all identify as human beings by seeing the commonalities we have, and that we have much more in common with each other, no matter what color our skin is, no matter who we're attracted to or how much money we don't have or we do have. We have much more in common than these differences that appear to divide us. And once you can get a foundation in that common humanity, the differences we have become assets. They become things to cherish. They truly become strengths. And that's something that our students exhibit all the time. Now, the purpose and the belonging is all tied in with that. When you identify as a human being who is here to help other people and to be a peacemaker in society, there is your purpose. And when you truly relate to the common humanity that we have, you can travel the world and feel at home wherever you go. And I've been very fortunate to do quite a bit of traveling in the past. In this year, I've been to the UK. I've been to Norway for the second time. I've been to Abu Dhabi, to Bosnia, and all over the United States. And everywhere I go, I feel at home. I feel that I'm with my people, and my people being the human race.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I really believe that that's something that anyone can achieve with practice.
Sure, okay. What's your understanding of the middle way, Arno, and how might it relate to what we've been talking about today?
When I think of the middle way, I think of openness, and I think of impermanence.
Okay.
I'm a Buddhist, and a lot of what I talk about, you know, it's just Dharma 101. And the beautiful thing about Dharma, or the teachings of the Buddha, is that they're really rooted in universal truths that are part of all sorts of faith traditions, and also part of all sorts of secular humanist traditions. It's not particular to Buddhism. It's not particular to any one faith tradition. And when I think of the middle way, I do think of spirituality. And to me, spirituality is engagement with noble human qualities like love and like forgiveness and compassion and kindness. And fortunately for us human beings, there are literally an infinite number of ways to engage with those qualities. And I believe that when we truly look at life from a spiritual perspective, we are inspired when we come across new ways of doing that, rather than intimidated. So when you see someone who believes that they're motivated by religious reasons to close themselves to other spiritual expression, I think that's a very good indication that they don't understand what spirituality is about. And so in the context of a middle way, I think it's really about saying, you know, hey, I don't know everything.
Yeah.
It's about releasing certainty.
Yeah, yeah.
It's about saying, you know, I could be wrong about this.
Sure.
But so far in my life, from my experience, this is what I've come to believe.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to discuss that. I'm happy to put it up for debate. And if someone can prove me wrong, then by all means, I'll accept that proof. And as far as like the middle way is concerned, I think it's something that's unfortunately sorely lacking from politics, especially in the United States. But I, you know, having just been in the UK and actually shortly after election time, I got you know, an earful of and kind of a primer on the political situation there. And I saw that, you know, there's a lot of similarities to the political strife that we see here. But when I think the middle way is a solution in many ways to say, hey, you know what, you even though I don't agree with you, it doesn't mean that you don't, your ideas are don't have value.
But it's messy in the middle as well, though, isn't it, Arno? You know, in some ways,
oh, sure,
the extremes are, in some ways, are easier, but you know, it's, as you say, it's this acknowledgement of uncertainty that often feels quite uncomfortable at times. But that's where creativity and where we can you know, move forward, arguably.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's unfortunately it's kind of ingrained in our Western society that saying I don't know or I could be wrong is seen as a weakness. And for a politician, God forbid that they should change their mind on anything ever in their lives. Because if they do, their opponents are going to pounce on it and going, see, they don't even know what they're talking about. They're changing their minds already. And yeah. I never changed my mind. It's ridiculous to me that that's seen as an asset in our political in our political arena. Is like, oh, I never changed my mind. I'm steadfast. And in a world where change is constant, to not change your mind seems almost suicidal to me.
But I think also, when people are honest about their mistakes, often people respect that. There's apparently an incident in American politics, you know, after the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy actually spoke to the American people and said, you know, listen, I fucked up here. I really made a big
right.
mistake. And,
right.
and his ratings went up.
Oh, absolutely. Because I think... When, first of all, it's very refreshing to see that, to see a politician do something that you rarely see a politician do. President Obama has done that on a different scale recently when he came out in support of same-sex marriage. When he campaigned for president in 2008, he said, well, I believe marriage is between a man and a woman, and that's very important. But he said it in kind of a, you know, an appeasing democratic way and enough that he could still get elected. But when later on he said, you know what, I've spent time with gay people and I've become close with them. And now I believe that denying them the right to show their commitment and love to each other is wrong. And so I have changed my mind on this. And I was absolutely inspired when that happened. I was like, that's the Obama I voted for twice. You know, that's my guy. Yeah. And I felt that the same way that I'm sure many people must have felt in response to President Kennedy admitting his mistakes. So I think it is a powerful thing. And again, it takes courage. It takes a lot more courage to do that than it does to adhere to either political pole. And it's something I can very much relate to because I'll never fault anyone who doesn't buy my story or doesn't believe that I'm sincere. I've done things that should cause any person to not to trust me. So I can't fault anyone if that trust, that mistrust is still there. But at the same time, because I try to be as honest and open as I can, I've had an overwhelmingly positive response to my story. The people who tend to not like me and not like what I do are people on the very far right or the very far left. And that's because the very far right, you know, denies that racism exists, and the very far left doesn't like me because I don't hate racists enough.
Yeah.
So it's like it kind of concretes my idea that the political spectrum is a circle, not a line. And that when you go far enough in either direction, they tend to meet.
Meet up, yeah. Okay, my last question, Arno. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Well, I would invite anyone listening to visit serve2unite.org. That's serve with the number 2 and the word unite.org. And there you can see the work that our students do as they're out conceiving their own service learning projects, doing things to help people in their community, and connecting with amazing global peacemakers like Bjorn Ehler, who really had an amazing impact on a middle school that we worked with. A 12-year-old kid asked Bjorn, how could you not want to hurt the man who killed your friends? And Bjorn said, just in beautiful simplicity, he said, because that's not the kind of person I am, and he's not going to change me.
Wow.
He's not going to make me be that someone that I'm not. And he also pointed out that by staying true to who he was, being someone who doesn't believe in violence, that dealt probably a more devastating blow to Breivik than coming at him with animosity could.
Sure.
So if you go to serveunite.org, you'll see a video of that exchange. You'll see art projects our students have done, coverage from news agencies of work that our students have done. And I would invite everyone to visit our website. And probably most importantly, if you're on social media, please share the content that our students create. Because unfortunately, in the social media world, negative content tends to get a lot more attention than positive content. So we need our listening audience's help in amplifying the voices of our very brave students who are trying to make a positive impact in the world. Beyond that, I have a personal website. It's at mylifeafterhate.com. And if anyone for some strange reason didn't get their fill of Arno in this podcast, they can go to that website and Arno themselves silly. My book's also available there as well.
Okay, well, thanks very much for talking to me today, Arno. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise, Barry. I really appreciate being on, and I really appreciate the spirit of the podcast. So thanks for doing it, and I look forward to listening to your other ones.
Brilliant.
Take care.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.